This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Hyperbaric Medical Solutions. If you suffer from a diabetic complication, radiation damage, stroke, or a degenerative condition, hyperbaric oxygen therapy may be right for you. Ask your doctor about how HBOT can help you achieve your optimal health. Call Hyperbaric Medical Solutions at 844-877-HBOT or visit hyperbaricmedicalsolutions.com/Hoffman to learn more. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about a nutrient that perhaps many of you, unless you're a true nutrition aficionado, may not have heard about, but it's a nutrient that has great potential, and there's a lot of research that supports its application to the treatment of a variety of conditions. We're going to talk to an expert. He's performed extensive research on this and other subjects related to nutritional support for medical conditions, but he's also a researcher in his own right looking at such problems as allergy and autism. He's Dr. Theoharis. He's an MD, PhD. He's a professor of pharmacology and internal medicine and director of molecular immunopharmacology and drug discovery at Tufts University School of Medicine. And he has an enormously long CV. If I read it, it would take up the entire podcast. So without further ado, here's Dr. Theoharis. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be actually on your program, sir.
Well, thank you very much. So, well, first of all, there is a connection, and you've written and researched extensively on this, between allergy and certain disorders where we don't really suspect allergy as a potential cause, and that would be autism. And then, of course, we'll get into the role that luteolin, we'll find out what it is, may play in slowing the progression or even ameliorating the symptoms of conditions like autism. Okay, so describe the research you've been doing in this area.
Sure. Thank you very much for your kind introduction, as well as the introduction, at least in this part of our research. Let me start by first saying that there is a lot of confusion about what we call allergies, as well as confusion about another medical term that is used, which is called atopy, spelled A-T-O-P-Y, as well as another term that is used, which is intolerance, and sometimes we say food intolerance. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about allergies, we look for increased levels of immunoglobulin called immunoglobulin E or IgE in the blood, as well as immunoglobulin E that may be made specifically for certain triggers. We call those allergens or antigens.
So this might be, this might be a classic allergy, like say you're allergic to dairy.
That is correct.
Or you're allergic to ragweed
or
something.
Allergy. If someone is allergic to penicillin, they shoot you up with penicillin, you go into what we call anaphylactic shock. So typically we would ask for the whole IgE, the total amount of IgE, as well as what we call immune IgE or a test called RAST, R-A-S-T, and that could be to 1 or 100 different antigens. So we might ask for IgE specific for gluten, for casein, for dust mites, for mold, etc. Then we have what we call food intolerance, which is not typically quantitative, is mostly qualitative. In those tests, we look for another class of immunoglobulins called IgG4, and you could do a panel of 200 plus foods, but there's a caveat with that, and that's why the academies, both in Europe and in the United States of allergy immunology, don't necessarily believe it 100%, because if you have been eating something every day, it will most likely turn out to be positive.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we pay attention to it if it's, you know, five pluses or the horizontal bar is all the way to the right, as long as someone has not been eating those foods every day.
Mm-hmm.
So I take that as qualitative, not quantitative. And then we're left with individuals who do not have either that or the other, but they have a propensity to respond with symptoms that are very reminiscent of allergies. So they might itch, they might turn red, etc. But they're not positive on either the food intolerance test or the true allergy test. And now there is a new diagnosis for that. It is called mast cell activation syndrome, because it is the mast cells that we know are involved in allergies. But in this latter case, the mast cells fire to triggers that do not involve any immunoglobulin, whether it's IgG4 or IgE. So it might be pressure. It might be a difference in temperature. It might be stress, etc., etc., etc.
Is it, so suffice it to say that these people are like, they're sort of like allergy factories. They sort of manufacture their own histamine.
In fact, they are not only that, but they're absolutely miserable. And I will indicate in a second why, although it might be obvious. But what is important is there is also a diagnosis in the books of multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome. And this latter diagnosis overlaps a lot with mast cell activation syndrome, and maybe in the next couple of years the two will merge. But we should keep in mind that when we talk about allergies, or at least when I talk about allergies in my research, I include the whole universe of these problems and not necessarily the true allergic patients, even though there is evidence to that effect as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has been so difficult to diagnose these patients, on average they go 10 years and as many physicians, and many times our colleagues unfortunately will think they're crazy because they present with so many different symptoms. After about 3 years of trying, last July we published a review in the New England Journal of Medicine, the title of which is Mast Cells, Mastocytosis, and Related Disorders. And we opened up the door with a very important figure where we show the mast cells in the center with arrows going to every organ of the body and various molecules released from the mast cells affecting those organs, because unfortunately we've been associating with mast cells only with histamine, which is of course released from mast cells, but it is the only molecule for which we have something that can undo their action after it has been released, the so-called antihistamines.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have drugs that can block the release of histamine and or another 100 molecules that are released by these mast cells, except, as we will talk later, luteolin and related compounds.
Okay.
So in our research, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
The term histamine intolerance has become popular, and people are put on low histamine diets, and they're given certain supplements sometimes to treat that. Is this a subset of this larger syndrome, mast cell activation syndrome, or are they synonymous?
Actually, they're not synonymous at all.
Okay.
The histamine intolerance indicates either one of three things, at least in my mind. Number one, that you might be missing the enzyme diamine oxidase
right.
that breaks down histamine.
For which you can now take supplements. You can actually
individual.
Take them. You can actually take oral supplements that help boost
Correct,
your DAA.
Correct, except that supplement can only act in the intestine because it's an enzyme. It cannot be absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not likely to help you with the effect of histamine in other organs of the body.
Right.
So one category, therefore, is that someone is missing the enzyme, and one can look for it genetically. The second would be any one of the categories of the patients that we just discussed would be extremely sensitive to the effects of histamine, but that, by definition, is not histamine intolerance. In other words, atopic individuals, let's just use that term for every type of allergy that I briefly mentioned, would be exquisitely sensitive to histamine because of either the genetic makeup or whatever else is going on. histamine intolerance could be in addition to having those problems. In other words, an allergic individual is likely to release more histamine in response to whatever the trigger is, and the histamine, of course, it will do all the damage that it does. However, those individuals who have histamine intolerance will do even worse because they cannot break down the histamine. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an additional problem.
Right.
And we often, erroneously, associate histamine intolerance with histamine toxicity. The reason is that there are many fish products, especially cod, that if it is left overnight, mm-hmm. and of course definitely so if it is left to spoil, all the fish contain bacteria which are otherwise innocuous. But if the bacteria are allowed to quote-unquote ferment, they make more histamine, and we have many times cases of cod or histamine poisoning, which is not poisoning because of bacteria growing, but because of the bacteria producing way too much histamine.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, all of those individuals, whether they're allergic, intolerant, mastocytosis, or mast cell activation disease, etc., they have to be very careful with the kind of foods that contain histamine. And there's a wonderful site, www.thelowhistaminechef, that gives a lot of information about different foods that contain histamine. We know cheeses contain histamine, smoked products contain histamine, tomatoes, nectarines contain a lot of histamine, so we just have to watch out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, in our own research, we have been fascinated by the fact that many diseases where you're not truly allergic, so that you have high IgE or immune IgE, appear to involve release of molecules for the mast cells. And as you very kindly indicated earlier on, then many of them. So we have evidence that migraines, multiple sclerosis, psoriasis, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, in fact, fit into that category. And most recently, over the last 3 years, we and now other colleagues have produced evidence of a very strong association with autism. If you would like me, I can give some examples of those pieces of evidence.
Please do.
Would that be okay?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So there are 5 different pieces of evidence of such a strong association by different colleagues. Colleagues like Dr. Ashwood, Dr. Zimmerman, Dr. Van der Water had published years ago, almost 8 years ago, that certain cytokines, molecules that are released by immune cells, are high in the blood of patients on the spectrum, as well as in the brain, in those cases where unfortunately certain patients had died because of either car accidents or drownings where one had access to the brain. Up to that point, there was no direct association with allergies in the broader sense, because such cytokines like interleukin-6 and TNF, called tumor necrosis factor, can be released by many other immune cells, so they're not specific for mast cells. However, that had triggered our interest. Then, we did an epidemiological study that was published almost 10 years ago, where we looked for the children that have the disease mastocytosis, where these children have many more mast cells than a normal individual, and these mast cells are more likely to fire to all kind of different triggers, as we said earlier. And 10 years ago, the chance of a child with mastocytosis having autism was 1 in 10 years ago. And whenever we talk about comorbidities, meaning 2 different diseases occurring at the same time, we multiply the ratio or the prevalence. So mastocytosis, we think it's 1 in 2,000 people. 10 years ago, we thought autism was 1 in 100. So the chance of the 2 diseases occurring should have been 1 over 2,000 times 1 over 200.
Yeah.
Definitely not 1 in 10.
Exactly. There's got to be some correlation.
So then we started looking for the possibility that there might have been publications that were missed. And in fact, there were publications that showed there was very strong statistical significance between food intolerance especially to gluten and casein, and children of the spectrum. Then we did a number of studies indicating, but our patient number was about 50 or so, that there was in fact strong association between the occurrence of allergies, especially asthma and skin problems, and autism. While we were doing those, and we published them, two very important studies were published by other colleagues. One study was by Dr. Mostafa from Egypt, who he was one of the three people, other than Dr. Van der Water and Ashwood and Zimmerman, that had shown that in 30% of children of the spectrum, their antibodies against their brain, autoantibodies mm-hmm. against their brain. That was very important to us as a finding, because that meant that the blood-brain barrier had become disrupted at some point in order for the circulating immune cells that never get into the brain normally to get into the brain, that recognize it as foreign, attack it and make antibodies.
And it suggests autism may be an inflammatory disorder of the brain, at least to some extent.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely, yes. And for us it was important because we had published many papers in very good journals that the mast cells line up the so-called blood-brain barrier that protects the brain, and if they are activated, the mast cells, they open up the blood-brain barrier, and then toxins from the environment or the gut can get into the brain and cause local inflammation. Mm-hmm. Now, the important finding from Dr. Mostafa was that he published that the children that had about 30% antibodies against the brain, the only thing that correlated significantly with that was the presence of allergies. So that was very important. And then a study was done in addition to about five others, but this one was unique because Kaiser Permanente, the insurance company that covers most Californians, looked at about 27,000 children and recorded, and it was published about 6 months ago, what, if any, other diseases tracked significantly with the autism spectrum disorders. And it was only allergy and asthma. Hmm. So I don't think there's any doubt, and it shouldn't be any doubt in our minds, that at least a major subgroup of the children with autism has at least the propensity to have allergies, which let's call it atopy, sort of in general. Having that evidence, the question is, how do we actually show that in the laboratory, and how do we actually block it? Mm-hmm. Let me stop that so you might ask.
Okay, sure. And that's the key question is, let's posit that there is that connection. You know, we have an arsenal of drugs at our disposal for allergies. We use antihistamines. We use leukotriene inhibitors like Singulair. There's even steroids. So is that a good idea for these kids, just to tank them up on medications, or would it prove futile?
Okay. A general answer to your question is no. But number one, I would like to make sure as quickly as possible, if they are truly allergic or have food intolerance, or they belong into any one of the other categories. And there is a set of tests that we can do in the blood and in urine, but 24-hour urine, and I can return to that if you would like me to, mm-hmm. to make sure that we don't miss those. For instance, if someone is truly allergic, I will give them antihistamines. If they have asthma, I will give them, you know, Singulair. If they have, you know, edema, I might even give them a little ibuprofen. So there are a number of things we can do to make sure that we at least address those problems that are addressable. And I will give you an example of how complicated the problem may be. I saw a patient recently on Cyprus, where I go and see patients as well as, you know, on Greece at times. And this, as many children of the spectrum, are very hyperactive. Yet, hyperactivity is not part of the diagnosis of autism. Autism is diagnosed as dysfunction of communication and sociability. Mm-hmm. Yet, in my book, 90% of the children are hyperactive at one point or another. So, I feel very strongly that we should actually investigate the hyperactivity and not necessarily just try to address it if we can. So, in this particular case, I would measure in any hyperactive child those molecules that we know can contribute to hyperactivity. That would be epinephrine, norepinephrine, dopamine, glutamine, etc. So we measure those. So in this particular case, epinephrine was off the roof.
Mm-hmm.
That is impossible in a normal individual. Make a long story short, the moment we have very high, as we call them, catecholamines,
mm-hmm.
one should at least exclude the possibility of a rare syndrome, which is not cancer, but it's called carcinoid syndrome,
mm-hmm.
where different cells in the intestine, not the mast cells, they're called enterochromaffin cells, make serotonin and exclude the possibility, which was the case actually, of something called pheochromocytoma,
mm-hmm.
which is a benign tumor of the adrenal glands that puts out tons of epinephrine, and one could pick it up with a CAT scan and then go retroperitoneally and remove it. And in fact, that's exactly what was the case. The child did not have autism.
Hmm.
So we should not necessarily throw everything into the autism basket just because, especially when children have other symptoms that are not the typical symptoms of.
Right.
Now, having said that, if a fire is roaring, in other words, if a child is covered, let's say, with atopic dermatitis or chronic urticaria, chronic itching, and I've excluded whatever I can exclude, I would actually, depending on the age, give them a little cortisone or an equivalent drug to calm the fire down. I will give them some antihistamine and their choices that we can talk about so that the child doesn't scratch like crazy because that will make them hyper and miserable. And then allow myself to come in with luteolin or similar natural products so that over time, it usually takes, 3 to 4 months to keep the mast cells from being easily triggered. Let me stop there again, and we can return to whatever you like.
Well, this is a good juncture at which to stop, because I think you've laid the groundwork for a discussion of luteolin, because we now know that inflammation, or you call it mast cell activation syndrome, we've coined a new medical term, may be at the root of autism, and later we'll discuss its potential application to other medical conditions. We divide these podcasts into two parts. So in part two, we're going to do a deep dive on luteolin and how luteolin, perhaps in conjunction with other nutraceuticals, may offer the prospect of neuroprotection for those suffering from autism and other disorders that may involve brain inflammation. Our guest is Dr. Theo Harides. He's professor of pharmacology, internal medicine director of molecular immunopharmacology and drug discovery at Tufts University School of Medicine. And we'll be right back with part two of today's Intelligent Medicine podcast.